Hi, Angie.
Hi, Nick.
Are you ready to dive into some tarot history?
I am so excited to get into this one. I have been really enjoying doing this whole series so far, and yeah, it's been a pleasure to research it, to learn for my own purposes, but I also anticipate that a lot of people will be waiting for this episode.
Yes, me too. Me too. And I've been learning so much, and it's just helped me to like thread the through line, all the way through. I feel like so often when we learn history, we just learn in pieces. And this is really helping me, make it all make sense all together in one straight story. So I'm loving it.
I agree. Yeah.
So yeah, like you said, this week we're diving into what is probably the most widely documented period of tarot history, which is the birth of Western occultism, the rise and prominence of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, and the global phenomenon that has become the Smith-Waite tarot deck.
So if you're new to this series, we recommend that you go back and start at the beginning so you can get the full story. We've covered over 300 years of history already, and the story really does build on itself.
And if you're enjoying this series so far, please take a moment to leave a rating and review wherever you podcast, which will help new listeners discover us. And consider supporting the work by joining our In Search of Tarot Patreon community. For as little as $2 a month, you'll be able to enjoy weekly essays and discounts on readings and workshops, as well as receive invitations to join our monthly tarot hangs, which have really become a special time to be in dialogue with other tarot readers and thinkers from literally all over the world. We have people that join us from all over the globe. And our Patreon members also get early access to all of these podcast episodes. So if you don't want to have to wait quite as long to hear the next chapter of this tarot history, you can join us there and you can listen a little bit early. So we'll link that in the show notes for you if you're interested. All right, Angie, you want to kick us off?
So, as we now know, although tarot decks have been traced back to the 15th century, the ideology that transformed these playing cards into something more was not codified until 2 centuries later, during the European Age of Enlightenment. A preceding century of religious conflict led thinkers of this era to seek to curtail the political power of organized religion. It is of little surprise then that Jean-Baptiste Alliet's Etaila, or a way to entertain yourself with a deck of cards, was very popular. It is the first book we find detailing a how-to for cartomancy, and it was published in 1770. As the title of the book suggests, Alliet, who went to assume the pseudonym Etaila, based his tarot ideology primarily around entertainment. But the popularity and demand for his work soon took it in another direction. Indeed, Etaila began to publish his own tarot deck, along with additional writings, organizing the cards into now what is familiar as the major and the minor arcana.
Etaila was a member of the Freemasons, the largest worldwide secret society, which evolved from the guilds of stonemasons and cathedral builders during the Middle Ages. The order received immediate resistance from religious leaders as its teachings of morality, charity, and obedience to the law of the land threatened the church's absolute authority. Freemasons are known for adopting the rites and trappings of ancient religious orders and chivalric brotherhoods, particularly during the 17th and 18th centuries when Etaila was involved. However, according to P.D. Newman, quote, "The first person to posit the notion that tarot was a repository of the ancient Egyptian religion was former French Protestant pastor and Freemason Antoine Coeur de Gebelin, who lived from 1725 to 1784," end quote. In his book, The Primeval World, Analyzed and Compared to the Modern World, Gebelin wrote that upon first laying eyes on what is now known as the Tarot de Marseille, he immediately related the cards to the, quote, "ancient Egyptian mysteries," end quote. As a French pastor, Gebelin's credentials for understanding Egyptian history are questionable at best, but there is another association he made that would become important in the development of tarot ideology, the four cardinal virtues.
So, sometime after the mid-18th century, lectures pertaining to the virtues became a regular part of Masonic ritual. To quote again from Newman, speaking on Gebelin, quote, "The cards wherein he saw an indication of the cardinal virtues were those labeled temperance, force, which is strength in English and suggestive of fortitude, and justice. However, much to his dismay, he did not find a card titled Prudence. On the other hand, one thing did jump out to him as being odd. The figure of the Hanged Man card was erroneously, Gibelin believed, inverted. If the Hanging Man was to be turned right side up, Gibelin reasoned that the impression given would be one of a man with hands hidden behind his back, standing on one foot. For Gibelin, such an image, with its subtle indications of graceful poise and wise reserve, was perfectly fitting to represent the missing virtue, end quote. Gibelin's work was influential on Itella, whose decks began to incorporate the cardinal virtues, reordering the trumps and placing the cards in question in chronological order, as well as inverting the Hanged Man and renaming it Prudence.
In his study, Promethean Ambitions, Indiana University professor of history and philosophy, William R. Newman, points out that, quote, the hackneyed modern view that automatically equates alchemy with witchcraft, necromancy, and a potpourri of other practices and theories loosely labeled the occult has little historical validity before the 19th century, end quote. In fact, according to Leah DeVun's book, The Shape of Sex, Non-Binary Gender from Genesis to the Renaissance, quote, alchemy became a topic of increased interest in Europe beginning in the mid-12th century, when a number of influential Greek and Arabic natural, philosophical, and alchemical texts became available in Latin translation, end quote. And you might remember Mary Kay Greer's mention of this that we quoted in our first episode of this series. Alchemical research during this time focused not only on transmuting metals, but also treating human bodies through medical remedies, drawing principles from university-taught disciplines of medicine and natural philosophy. So what Newman is really pointing out here is that before the 19th century, alchemy was viewed a lot more as a science rather than an occult practice. Whereas, you know, nowadays we kind of think of alchemy as this sort of magical principle. But, you know, if you think of, probably a lot of you have heard of the idea of the humors in the body and the balancing of the humors. And, you know, that is alchemy. And so alchemy really was thought as a science rather than an occult idea until, you know, the 19th century.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, I actually just read that book, The Shape of Sex. It's very academic, but it is really interesting. And particularly towards the end, it starts to point out some things about Gemini, like the astrological sign of Gemini being related to non-binariness. And also just a lot of visual depictions of non-binary people throughout the Middle Ages that I had never seen. The book is full of imagery and plates from that time. So it's pretty interesting. If anyone's interested in a new book, I recommend it.
That sounds fascinating. Okay, so as the 19th century occult movement began to synthesize, one of its most influential figures was Eliphas Levi, who lived from 1810 to 1875. A Freemason himself, Levi's work, The Dogma and Ritual of High Magic, presented new unified theories linking ceremonial magic with astrology, alchemy, and Kabbalah. These invented connections would go on to have enormous influence on the subsequent magical and occult orders, including the Theosophical Society and the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. Levi was somewhat of a tarot purist, and therefore he returned the cards to their original naming and ordering from the Tarot de Marseille. He also saw an allusion to the doctrine of the, quote, world savior in The Hanged One, and decided that it was the hermit who corresponded with the cardinal virtue of prudence. A few years prior to the founding of the Golden Dawn, a woman named Helena Blavatsky established the Theosophical Society on November 17, 1875. Through her teachings, Blavatsky purported the existence of an ancient secret brotherhood with spiritual masters with a direct lineage to an ancient magical religion. In an episode of Dig podcast focusing on theosophy, historian Sarah Handley Cousins explains that, quote, according to Blavatsky's theory, there were seven root races, each existing in a slightly different time period and place on Earth, kind of an alternate human evolution, end quote. And while the initial goal of theosophy may have been one of unification and universal brotherhood, its teachings on race would go on to inspire an entire generation of Nazi leaders.
According to Susan Johnson Graf's book, Talking to the Gods, quote, the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn was a secret organization formulated in London in 1887 for the purpose of occult study and practice, end quote. The group would go on to serve as the basis for many 20th century so-called New Age beliefs. The beliefs and practices of the Golden Dawn were cobbled together from many disparate sources, including Egyptian, Hindu, Buddhist, Jewish, Christian, and Greek traditions. To quote Graf again, quote, within the Golden Dawn worldview, reality was seen as multi-layered. The mundane world was thought to be interpreted by other realities that could be entered through ritual and meditative visualization, end quote. At first glance, Theosophy and the Golden Dawn seem almost identical, but there are a few differences that are important to point out. The Golden Dawn was much more concerned with the secrecy of its teachings. All members had code names, and the society was devoted to the study of occult science and the magic of Hermes. And you know, Angie, I can't help but kind of laugh to myself when I study these things because, you know, it's interesting that like the woman's organization is not interested in the secretness. And it just makes me think of like little boys playing, you know, playing games as kids, or, you know, like playing spy or something, or like, you know, yeah, getting off on sort of the secrecy of all of it just kind of makes me giggle, you know?
It's kind of funny. Yeah. And when you frame it like that.
Yeah. Founding member Samuel Lydell McGregor Mathers developed intricate rituals to be performed by members of the order as they progress through various grades. According to the book Witchcraft Today, an encyclopedia of Wiccan and neo-pagan traditions by James R. Lewis, quote, Mathers was a relative of Alice Lydell, whose father co-authored the most important Greek dictionary of the 19th century, and whose adventures in Wonderland were chronicled by the Reverend Charles Ludwig Dodson, perhaps better known as Lewis Carroll, end quote. I think that's really a fascinating bit of history that I actually dug into for this episode because I've covered Mathers before in classes that I've taught. And a student actually brought that up, you know, asking that question because of the Lydell of it all. Mm-hmm. And at the time I wasn't sure, but I did some more digging for this episode. And it does appear that at least according to this book that I found, they were related. So it's interesting.
That is, what an interesting connection.
Yeah. In 1888, In an 1888 article titled Practical Occultism, Blavatsky voiced her distaste for the complicated nature of the Golden Dawn system. Additional writings by Blavatsky indicate her wish that Theosophy remain open and accessible to anyone wishing to study, a difference in attitude from the closed, members-only approach of the Golden Dawn.
It appears that opinions on how the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn should be organized and codified varied amongst the insiders as well. In early 1892, Mathers implemented a radical reorganization of the Golden Dawn, which included an establishment of a secret second order in which he installed himself as the sole chief. I found that really interesting. It was like, well, I will put myself at the head of this club. I'm the president now.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
While the original order focused more on theory and philosophy, the new second order dealt more with the practical use of magic, which, according to the book Theosophy and the Golden Dawn by David Riegel, quote, required its initiates to make their own magical instruments. The rose croix lemon, the lotus wand, the magical sword, and the four elemental weapons, the wand for fire, the cup for water, the dagger for air, and the pentacle for earth, end quote.
And like, hello, right? Like, there's the elements, you know, yeah. There we have it.
Yeah. According to Francis King, a foremost scholar of Western occultism, quote, the Western technique is aimed at the incarnation of spirit in matter, end quote. Graf explains that for the Golden Dawn adepts, quote, the practice of magic was an active, willful, knowledgeable manipulation of reality on symbolic correspondences and active imagination, end quote. Symbols weren't seen as metaphors, but rather as containing innate powers unto themselves. William Butler Yeats, himself a member of the Golden Dawn, wrote, quote, it is the first principle of our illumination that symbols and formulas are powers, which act in their own right with little consideration for our intentions, however excellent. Most of us have seen some ceremony produce an altogether unintended result because of the accidental use of some wrong formula, end quote.
Enter American-born British poet, writer, and occultist Arthur Edward Waite, who began researching psychic and occult topics following the death of his sister in 1874. In 1891, Waite joined the Golden Dawn, just 1 year prior to the establishment of Mather's Second Order. He would go on to devote his life to requiring the liturgies of many secret societies, including the Holy Royal Arch, the Knights Templar, the Knights of Malta, and the early Grand Scottish Rite. Waite believed in the existence of a secret tradition, a deeper form of Christianity that had been passed down verbally through generations of secret traditions and texts.
According to the Book of Artists by Henry Tuckerman, quote, Pamela Coleman Smith was born in London and traveled between Jamaica, London, and New York as a child, eventually studying at the Pratt Institute in New York City. Her grandfather, Samuel Coleman, was a prolific American publisher based in New York City who was primarily known for joining image to verse. The National Encyclopedia of American Biography details that Samuel Coleman's publishing house was also amongst the first to produce color illustrations, end quote. Smith followed in her grandfather's footsteps and set up shop as a commercial illustrator in London. She created art for a volume of William Butler Yeats's verse, and it was Yeats himself who would go on to usher her into the Golden Dawn in 1901. It was there that she would meet A.E. Waite and remain loyal to him when he splintered off from the order in 1903. Waite commissioned Smith to create 78 original drawings for a new tarot deck, the first in English. Unlike most previous decks, Waite's tarot would be primarily for divination and the images intentionally laden with meaning. In 1908, the British Museum acquired black and white photographs of the Sola Busca deck. You might remember this deck from our first episode. That Sola Busca deck dates back to 1490, and it is the first known deck to illustrate with all of the pip cards. It would prove inspirational to Pamela Coleman Smith, the artist Waite would go on to choose to draw his deck. And as Laura June Topolsky points out in an Atlas Obscura article, quote, several of the cards in both decks are almost identical in design, end quote. In just 6 short months, guided by Waite's divinatory interpretations, Smith pulled from her influences, Golden Dawn beliefs fusing Christianity, Judaism, and beyond. A heavy emphasis on the power of symbols and numbers, and her exposure to the first fully illustrated deck, the Sola Busca, to produce what would become the world's most iconic tarot deck.
Non-Jewish occultists of this era believed that the Jewish Kabbalah offered a numeric and symbolic system that was mathematical in nature. According to Rigel, quote, Golden Dawn members believed that through learning the system of Kabbalah and its correspondences and using that system, the magician had reached a deeper, clearer understanding of the nature of reality than the scientist had yet to achieve, end quote. Although the Golden Dawn believed in the magical potential of the Kabbalah, and indeed A.E. Waite, himself a non-Jew, would go on to publish multiple books on the subject, their beliefs have been heavily discredited by Jewish scholars, such as Rabbi Gershom Shalom, who said, quote, even though Waite's sense of historical criticism may have been superior to that of other contemporary esoteric writers on Kabbalah, it still remained inadequate. He simply lacked the proper instruments needed for the task of really understanding Jewish Kabbalah, end quote. Former In Search of Tarot guest Zoe Jacoby of Jew Witches has detailed some of the specifics of the Smith-Waite deck that she believes contains the most outwardly Jewish imagery. The High Priestess with the Torah scroll across her lap, pomegranates floating behind her, the two pillars within the Temple of Solomon, and the Parashat veil, or the veil in the temple. The Wheel of Fortune, featuring the Hebrew letters YHVH, the sacred name of God, which in the Jewish faith is never meant to be written where it can be destroyed or erased, and the Devil, whose right hand is shown making a priestly blessing performed in Judaism. Many tarot writers and readers have also integrated the Kabbalistic concept of the Tree of Life into their interpretations. And you can read more on Zoe's blog on her website, jewwitches.com, which I encourage everybody to go visit. Zoe is an amazing resource. And you can also listen to my interview with her from season 3 of this podcast, which actually took place about a year ago to this date. So
nice.
In the Smith-Waite deck, we can really see the codification of a system for reading the cards coming through in the close relationship that emerges between Waite's interpretation of the card based on the elemental and astrological associations as assigned by the Golden Dawn and Smith's imagery. For instance, in his pictorial key to the tarot, Waite lists these key words for 9 of Swords: death, failure, miscarriage, delay, deception, disappointment, despair. or reversed, imprisonment, suspicion, doubt, reasonable fear, and shame. Smith illustrates these words clearly. A novice who might not use these exact words in their interpretation could intuit something very similar based on the way this image looks. So it's a real marriage of meaning and imagery that encourages the reader to adhere to what Waite is trying to get across and what he believes these cards mean.
When the Smith-Waite deck was originally released in 1909, it didn't immediately become the commercial success we know it as today. For that part of the history, we have to fast forward all the way to 1968 and introduce you to someone named Stuart Kaplan, who was then managing mines in West Virginia and Pennsylvania. While on a business trip in Germany, Kaplan happened to attend the Nuremberg Toy Fair during his downtime, where he discovered an odd little deck of cards that fascinated him. Even though he wasn't yet involved with US games, Kaplan had begun dabbling in game making himself and cut a deal to import a few thousand of the tarot decks that he had discovered, which are now known as the 1JJ Swiss Tarot, a variation of the Tarot de Marseille. Kaplan ended up selling a lot of these imported decks to large bookstores in the US, a venture which proved so successful that he started his own independent small business called US Games Inc. He was originally just running the company out of his home, and he began immediately looking for other decks to import, as well as writing books on the tarot, including his 1971 book titled Tarot Classic, which included the first mention of Arthur Waite. As soon as Kaplan released Tarot Classic, he wanted to have a deck to accompany the book, and he negotiated a deal with William Ryder & Son, the English company that held the rights to the Smith-Waite deck, to begin publishing what was then known as the Rider-Waite deck in America. With this deal, Kaplan was no longer importing this deck. He actually had the rights to publish it himself. By the mid-1970s, tarot was on its way to becoming popular in the mainstream, and almost everyone's cards came from the same place, US Game Systems, Inc.
Yes. And so, you know, here we have arrived at the end of our story today. And one thing that I want to sort of touch on is we didn't really discuss the relationship between Pamela Coleman Smith and A.E. Waite in terms of the way that she was kind of, her contributions were kind of erased historically, and also the way that she was kind of just, you know, very quickly asked to make these images. I can't remember exactly the amount of time that she did it in, but it was a very, very fast turnaround. There's a quote that you can find of her speaking about the way that she was, you know, paid and kind of just like pushed to the side. So, you know, there's a lot of research that you can find. There's a couple of books that just came out recently about Pamela Coleman Smith's life, that I would recommend, you know, you looking into. But I did want to just kind of touch on that because we didn't really talk about that. So this period that we've covered today from roughly 1725 to 1909, and then further into the 1970s, was a revolutionary time for the tarot because the Smith-Waite deck is now the most widely purchased and the most widely taught. It's important for practitioners to know the full history behind this deck and to know that they have a choice in whether or not they want to subscribe to its system of meanings, which was originally created by the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. And that's another thing I wanted to kind of just touch on is, you know, this is kind of a soapbox that I get on a lot, is the way that the Rider-Waite Smith deck is always, you know, or very often is a requirement for a tarot class, or is the deck that the teacher will, you know, always kind of lift up and maybe say, you know, well, you know, I recommend starting with the Smith Rider-Waite, but there are other decks you can also use, you know, and that's fine. I mean, I have multiple kind of issues about that that I've talked about here on the podcast before, so I won't really go into that now, but I also think that, you know, for people who really enjoy working with a system of interpretation, I just think for myself that, you know, I want to make sure I know where that system is coming from and sort of who created that system, how they created it. You know, I think knowing that the Golden Dawn did pull from influences that arguably they did not have the right to pull from when they were developing that system, I think it's just important to keep in mind, just so that you can proactively buy into it or not. I mean, that's really my thing, is that a lot when tarot is taught, it often isn't taught in a way where the student is sort of, you know, told, if you want to believe these interpretations, you can, or you don't have to. You know, I feel like a lot of times it's just kind of, this is what this card means. And so I would love to see more transparency from teachers in saying why this card means that.
Yeah, I agree. It's kind of like that moment in The Wizard of Oz where they go, don't look at that little man operating this whole thing from behind that green curtain. It's just kind of like not to dispose of the decks because, like you said, it's like I use the Rider Smithwaite from time to time, but it's important to kind of put it back in its proper context, not to
Right.
hold it up in this misconception.
Right.
So that brings us to the end of today's episode. All of our sources from this episode are listed below in the show notes. Please share your thoughts with us about any of this history by emailing us at isotpod@gmail.com. That's isotpod@gmail.com, or chatting with us on Instagram. Our handles are also listed in the show notes.
And next week, we're going to take a closer look at another infamous member of the Golden Dawn, Aleister Crowley, and his creation of the Thoth Deck and that system.